On today's episode, Earning Power, the best protection against inflation. Welcome to the ultimate crowdsource personal finance show. This is Choose FI.
You're listening to Choose FI Radio. The blueprint for financial independence lives here. If you're looking to unlock the secrets to financial independence and early retirement, you're in the right place. Stay tuned and join a community of like-minded people who are getting off the hamster wheel and taking control of their lives in the pursuit of financial independence. Choose FI, your home for financial independence online.
All right, guys, very excited to dive into this week's episode and help me with this. I have my co-host Brad here with me today. How you doing, buddy?
Hey, Jonathan, I am doing quite well. Yeah, it's just like a nice time of year right now. We actually, we have our pool opening pretty soon, which is...
It's like, honestly, we're like 5 years of announcing when the pool opens.
Well, it's a big deal, right? It's well, for us, it's where we frolic, as we like to say, every summer. And yeah, it's just, it feels like a nice change of season, right? Literally and figuratively.
Yeah, it's funny, man. As we moved into spring, like I have a German short hair pointer, beautiful dog, and it's a hunting breed, right? And so they have that kind of really gorgeous point where they find something and they find it and they point at it. And as spring has happened, the squirrels are just going crazy in my yard. And my dog is obsessed with just going outside and stalking them. I don't think she's ever caught one in her entire life. But she just gets caught up in, you know, hundreds, if not thousands of years of breeding. And she just looks at them, one paw off the other. And I was out there observing her do this, going through this routine that she does every morning. And I just switched into like David Attenborough mode. And I started narrating it. The dog takes one paw in front of the other. The wind is coming from the south. Have the squirrels detected? I narrated this whole thing out. And of course, my dog did not get it. But it was just like spring has arrived.
Yeah.
Everybody's enjoying it. And you know, it's funny for us. I know personally, like with kids, every new year, every new spring brings like our kids are just hitting a different age and a different set of experiences are coming right along with that.
Yeah, no, that's certainly true. And yeah, we kind of mark the years with how old our kids are in their swim team, which is interesting. And actually, I don't think I even mentioned this to you. And this kind of ties into FI in a sense, and I'll hopefully explain this right, but I wound up taking my older daughter, Anna, to her first concert, which was so, so cool. It was really just this like amazing father-daughter experience. And it really speaks to, I think, a lot of what we talk about here at Choose FI, right? In terms of you're not looking to leave your job or reach FI because you're hating your life or you're running away from something. You're running towards a life. And a lot of that has to do with making purchasing decisions based on value, not in terms of how can I pinch that last penny. That's an abhorrent thought to me. And I know it is to so many people, which is why like the financial independence movement got painted with a bad brush, with a very broad negative brush years ago. But I think you and I have tried our best to change the narrative in terms of it's not about being miserly. It's about finding what you want out of life and buying things based on value. And how that comes around to this concert was, so my daughter Anna is a huge fan of Olivia Rodrigo. I don't know if you've heard of her or not, but
I am at the stage, dude, where I have no idea where any of these people are. Like, I'm trying to remember what Taylor Swift looks like. That's how bad it is.
Oh, I hear you. So to probably about 50 million teenage girls, Olivia Rodrigo is like the most popular person in the world. Anna absolutely loves her. There was a concert in Washington, D.C. We tried to get tickets when she was selling them originally. They sold out early to like people on her email list or whatever. So we were shut out. And Anna just kept pining away for this. It just was something the girl never asked for anything. And she's such a good kid. And I knew we'd have such a good time. And I went up buying them in a very expensive manner, unfortunately, but on StubHub. And honestly, it was one of those things. It wasn't about the price. It wasn't about, I wasn't going to just save $100 or $200 and not go or whatever it may be, or find like the cheapest tickets or something, or take her to another artist that she wouldn't really like. She wanted to go to this. And Jonathan, it was on a Wednesday night in Washington, D.C. So if I was working a full-time job, this would have been really difficult. But I was able to take her the second she got home from school. We hopped in the car, drove 110 miles up to DC, and we just had this amazing, amazing time. And it's one of those things, I will remember her joy at that show for the rest of my life. Like, honestly, it is seared into my brain. And we just had such an amazing time together. And she'll never forget it. I'll never forget it. It was remarkable.
That's awesome, man. It's exciting to see these kids grow up and who the people they're becoming, and wonderful kid. And yeah, it's cool that you guys, you know, I think the thing is like time with your kids, right?
Yeah.
Time is our most precious non-renewable resource. You know, I'm not going to throw Elon under the bus here or any billionaires under the bus here, but these people that are like, they just like, they're in their 50s or 60s. They're running like 20 different companies. They are billionaires. How are you, like, do you ever see your kids? The goal for me is not to be the world's wealthiest person, right? And I think for many of us, it was never to like win the war to the person with the mostest. It was to reclaim our most precious non-renewable resource and then put that resource back into the people that we love the most. And I think that's something that I've seen you realize for a long time. It's been a primary motivating goal for you. And I think you consistently are that person. And it's something that I've really tried to develop. And, you know, that's something that I'm proud of, is like, how much time and energy can I put into my family and my kids? And it actually did. I mean, there have been points in the road where you have to make you come to a fork in the road. And one is, I can do more, I can be more, I can create more, I can do all these things. And there's some incentive on the other side, or I can choose, you know, family and kids and building those relationships. And I think, you know, the fact that FI is about optimizing and about getting to the point where you have separated your time from needing to work a 9-to-5 job, et cetera. But it's also about being able to put your most precious non-renewable resource into the people you love. And keep that in mind. I mean, you know, there is a path for you to earn $30 million. The question is, at what cost, right? At what cost? And so we're going to have a conversation today about income, but I think this is a good balancing act that, like, what is your why? What is your why of FI? Keep that anchored. There is a clear path to crushing the income. And we can give you those strategies regardless of your scenario. We absolutely, and we'll hit up most of those today, but your why should be a fundamental factor that is in the background. Now today, it's really interesting because we're actually building this episode on the one we did last week. It's episode 377. We were talking about a glide path to retirement. And we were talking about a glide path to retirement in the context of financial uncertainty and inflation. And this really tees us up to talk about, Brad, you actually sent it out in your newsletter this past week. It was a quote from Warren Buffett talking about really a superpower when it comes to combating inflation. And I'll give it back to you for that.
Yeah. As you certainly know, and the audience knows, I'm a big fan of Warren Buffett, and him and Charlie Munger had their annual Berkshire Hathaway annual meeting just a week or two ago here in May in Omaha. And there's always just these amazing takeaways from these two just brilliant, brilliant individuals. And this is the first time I've heard him talk about inflation, but not in the sense that we would expect. He said, the best protection against inflation is still your own personal earnings power. The best investment by far is anything that develops yourself. And Jonathan, that is super, super powerful, right? Your own personal earnings power, and the best investment is anything that develops you.
This is massive. And it's an opportunity for us to talk about it, just because, you know, not only is it contextually relevant here in the scenario where we're talking about how to battle inflation, but it's also just a massive piece of your savings rate. It's a massive part of how to reach financial independence. We always start when we're talking about, you know, building out this equation of financial independence. What you earn minus what you spend is equal to a difference, a gap, you know, some amount. If there is no difference, then we have a problem because you're spending everything you make, right? Now, when you're starting with the path to financial independence, general consensus, and by I mean general, I mean Brad and I would agree. that most people should start with like focusing on their expenses first, because it is something that you can have an immediate impact on. Actually, on a dollar for dollar basis, it goes farther, right? If you earn a dollar, taxes need to be paid on that money before whatever you have left, you know, you can then spend. Whereas if you cut a dollar, that is a post-tax dollar of savings, so it goes farther. We did a video, which you can have linked up a while back, called 5 Reasons to Start with Spending Less. And it talks through some of those incentives, but faster implementation, post-tax returns, and it makes everything else you do on the income side go farther, right? So your financial independence equation is based on how much your life actually costs. So every $100 a month in recurring monthly expenses that you can cut is $30,000 less that you do not need to account for in your financial independence equation. All right, so that's the expense side. But the income side, while there's only so much you can cut, right? You could cut, I guess, theoretically, the floor would be zero, theoretically. I'm not exactly sure what that looks like, but Jacob from Early Retirement Extreme is probably, you know, back in the day, was the one that probably got it the closest. I wonder if he's sustaining that. It'd be interesting to see what it looks like now. If he's still the same person now that he was in 2012, but that was a, sorry, sidebar, back to our focus. You know, whether it's zero or $5,000 a year or $30,000 a year or $50,000, whatever it is, there is probably some floor at which point it is going to cause significant sustained deprivation to accomplish it. And I think probably what I would, you know, we would both say is when you're starting out, test that line of deprivation and see if it is what you think it is. But once you've been there for a little bit, feel free to come back out and now you know what it is that you value. So whatever that line is, you know, of what your life actually cost, that's probably about what you're going to be willing to cut or to sacrifice, unless something extreme happens that makes you willing to tolerate deprivation for longer. But in a vacuum, most of us have a steady state, in which case, you know, that's what our expenses are going to be. All right. But there's no such restriction on your income. Your income can be anything and everything. So it really helps us to figure out what that steady state is first and quantify what that cost. And so now we can kind of fix that in place as a baseline. And now we're going to take our energy and we're going to move over to this income side of the variable. And we can put, this is a constant life strategy for our income earning years. This is something that we're never done with. And that poses real opportunity in light of what Warren Buffett said.
Yeah, I think it does. And for me, this has been one of the things that has changed the most on my own path to FI. And certainly the way that I conceptualize financial independence, really because of this podcast, because of what you and I have both learned and uncovered on this podcast, I kind of always thought about FI in terms of cutting expenses. For years, that was how I thought you really got wealthy, right? You had your income and you would cut expenses and you have your 40, 50, 60% savings rate. You work for 12 to 15 years and you ride off into the sunset. And that was how I thought of as FI. And I think now—
And what you did, and to be clear, it's not bad.
Right. No, you're absolutely right. But I think it was just such a limiting way of looking at the world. And frankly, like a lot of what we're going to talk about today is stuff that it just wasn't in my entire conceptual framework of how the world worked. Like increasing income or negotiating salary, all of these things. It was just for me. And let's be clear, I never lived a life of deprivation. That was never how we thought about our lives or really how we ever actually lived our lives. But again, I always thought FI was about cutting expenses. And I still, to some degree, if someone is starting out on the path to FI, I think the low-hanging fruit often starts with expenses. But like I said, 5 years ago, I would have said it started and ended with cutting expenses. And now I've realized the error of my ways and how, like you're saying, your income can really be, it's a math equation, right? It's what you earn minus what you spend is equal to that gap, as you described. And your income can go up significantly. And there are really time-tested, battle-tested ways of doing this that I wasn't aware of it. And I wonder, looking back, what my path would have been like, what my career might have been like, instead of staying at one job and kind of being frustrated at my little cost of living raises, right? Like, what could have been? So, Jonathan, I really wanted to make it personal because I think a lot of people can relate to that on their own paths to FI, but they don't have to stop there, you know? And I think that's really encouraging.
So, what is interesting about this conversation is college isn't really going to enter into it. I don't have a problem with college if the ROI is there and it works for you. But the takeaway on this episode is not going to be to go back to college. And I think, honestly, I mean, go get a skill. There's things that you can utilize. Yeah, it's so funny, Brad. 5 years ago, I was cynical in college, largely predicated on the fact that, like, I did 4 years of my undergrad. I did 4 years of pharmacy school. I got a degree along with six figures of student loan debt. And I, after several years, could barely tolerate the job. Like, it was, and it's even worse now. And I just think about that standard path that involves college in a vacuum where you're saddled by student loan debt. And the end goal is not a job, but just a degree. Like, hey, I'm just going to get a degree. That's the strategy. It's mind-numbingly frustrating. And so that's fine. As parents, we can all figure out what to do with our kids and how it's going to change. But it doesn't necessarily help those of us that already went to college, already have our bachelor's, or those of us that are in our late 20s or early 30s that are trying to figure out whether we should go back to college. Like, nothing that we're going to talk about going forward is going to involve you going back to school, back to college, right? You don't need to do that in this day and age.
Yeah. And that's interesting, right? I think when I was starting my career, I always had in the back of my mind, oh, someday I'm going to go get a master's degree or an MBA or whatever it may be. Like, I never really even took steps to do that, but like, it was there. And now today, I can't imagine a scenario where, and this is not talking about your bachelor's, right? Like, I clearly went to undergrad, got a bachelor's degree. I was able to get my CPA license from there. But yeah, like, I can't imagine a world where I would go back to school. It just seems like the opportunity cost. And I think that's what a lot of people don't really consider. It's not just what you're paying for that college. It's the foregone years, right, of potential earnings. So, I mean, there, like, that for anybody considering the cost of either A, college, or B, advanced graduate work, you have to consider, what are the earnings that I'm foregoing? Because really, that is a critical aspect. And in most cases, even as expensive as college can be in the US, what you're foregoing is going to be as much or more than what you're paying. So it's more than a double whammy.
Well, I mean, think about the scenario we just talked about. So Warren Buffett just says, you know, earning power, it's the best protection against inflation. So someone in their mid to late 20s, early 30s that recognizes they're undercompensated or they're losing to the inflation battle, right? Their take-home pay is just going to cover more and more of their just core expenses. They don't have extra saving. They see it slipping away and they're getting a 1% cost of living adjustment in a time where inflation's at 5, 6, or 7%, right? That's the scenario that you're describing. The idea that you're going to go back to college to fix that means you're going to lose at minimum 2 more years, at minimum $20,000, maybe closer to $40,000. And then you're going to be in a situation where you come out on the other side applying for jobs where everybody's asking for experience. You're like, I don't have experience. I just have a degree. I have a new degree. I'm qualified, but I don't have experience unless I have it from what I had before my prior job. So I just want to point out, that's the frame here. This is really not quite so much focused at, you know, 16, 17, 8-year-olds preparing to make that decision as much as this conversation around, all right, my best option is to increase my income in a context of inflation. How do I do that? All right, now moving forward. So as we move forward into this, it starts with just assessment. This is going to sound like just such a straightforward question. Do I like my job? Do I like my job? And maybe not my job, but my industry. Does it give me satisfaction? Does it make me happy? Is this where I want to be? Is that my first foremost bias? So we start there, right? Imagine each one of these is a fork in the road. Brad, if the answer is no, like, imagine it's yes. I mean, really, I'm going to keep tracking this down. So do I like my job? And I'm a dentist and I'm just miserable. I'm a pharmacist, or I'm just miserable. You know, like, if the answer is no, then we're like, well, I'm making 100,000. Maybe if I'm a dentist, 120, 150,000, somewhere in there. I hate it. The answer to that question is going to really determine where we go in how far we want to push. Because if we say it's a no, but it's like, then the next question is, do I like my job? No. Then, well, what's the problem with the job? Is it the industry? I hate having my hands in people's mouth. I thought I would like it when I was 17. I can't stand it. All right. That's different than I have a toxic boss, a toxic coworkers, a really horrible setup. It's funny with pharmacy, man. Like, I just don't know where you're going to go that it's going to get any better. It's been like with pharmacy in particular, it's been like a race to the bottom. Like, you know, there used to be like the one corporate pharmacy that was kind of good. And then the couple chains were kind of like really bad. All pharmacists look worn out now. And I see the threat. I used to think it was just me. I see in our Facebook group, like, people are asking about what they can do and whether they should go to pharmacy school, et cetera. And other pharmacists doing the same. I'm going to be honest, it's brutal, you know? It's just gotten worse since I left. So if you are in one of these toxic industries where there's nothing about it that seems redeeming from the time you're there to the time you are making a dime, and no one called you to fall on this sword, You do not owe the profession your life energy for the next whatever years. With dentists, you know, it's not industry specific. I personally have an axe to grind on pharmacy based on my own personal experience. I have no such axe to grind on dentistry, nor am I that familiar with whether it's good or background. I picked those two because they're in the same very long school, you know, et cetera. But it's anything. It's anything. The flow, it helps me to imagine the difference there. You know, with one, if the industry is bad, maybe you would consider changing industry. But the reason that pharmacy and dentistry are interesting as a place to start from is it is a very long time to get into them. And so it's that sunk cost fallacy that someone that says, well, if I spent 8 to 12 years getting into an industry, I can't afford to leave. I'm trapped. And you're not. You're simply not. Like, if you're making $100,000 a year, $150,000 a year, you can pivot into a completely new industry and replicate that within 1 to 3 years. It is 100% doable, 100% doable. And so some people have the pressure of, oh, I need to replace a six-figure income because I have all the debt that I took out along with that. Do not let yourself feel trapped.
Yeah. And I think that's the critical piece, right? Is not only don't let yourself feel trapped, don't get trapped. And I think both are important. And I understand where you're going, that even if, right, even if you have these years and even if you have student loan debt, you're still not trapped. But lowering, like we always talk about with your structural expenses, right? You don't want to get stuck in a scenario where you are reliant on every dollar of your income or your life is going to fall apart. Right. And this is really, really important. So you're talking about here, your two examples are pretty high paying careers, right? Certainly six figures and above. And if those people have essentially no savings and no savings rate, then it's going to be fairly difficult to have that space to be able to have flexibility to do anything, right? But I think one of the bedrock principles of financial independence, certainly, and even where you're going here with this concept of being able to change careers entirely, which seems really difficult for a lot of people. Like, that seems almost insurmountable mentally for a lot of people. But having that flexibility of A, having a net worth, right? Having a net worth that is potentially years of expenses, and B, having a significant savings rate means that, okay, I don't need to replace every single dollar of my income from tomorrow, right? If I wanted to leave this toxic environment, okay, for that pharmacist making $130,000 a year at the Globo Pharmacy, right? Like, okay, I don't need to replace all 130K because my life only costs 65 and I have 5 years of expenses saved up. Well, that's an entirely different scenario. And that hopelessness that you described before, I think a lot of that can be alleviated right there. And I think people might lose sight of that. And that's why I wanted to really slow down on that for a minute, is that's the underlying principle of a lot of this. And I don't think it takes away from where you're going. I think it's additive, really, and really further highlights the value of FI.
Hey, this is Andrew from the Choose a FI team. Hope you're enjoying the show. We're going to get right back to it after these quick messages.
Going back to this like flowchart idea, I just quickly went down, you know, the do I like my job? No. Do I like my job? Yes. And then that kind of teed up some variants to explore. And then that teed up some objections that people have. But I think even going up higher than that, like the do I like my job? Yes or no, regardless of what the variables are, tee us up for whether we're looking for a strategy that involves us staying in the same industry or whether or not we're looking to transition into a different one. If we're trying to stay in the same industry, so that could be, we want to stay in the same industry. It could be, we want to stay in the same, with the same company that we're with right now. You know, that's the question of, are we looking to get a raise? Are we looking to get a promotion? Versus, are we looking to just be better compensated for how good we are or how much we are already doing? And I think we have something to offer here. I'm going to point back to another episode. Episode, I believe it's 23. There's very few episodes now that we're 500 episodes in that I still can remember the number for. It's gotten harder, you know, as we cross that 500 episode gap. But episode 23 was one of our early episodes with Earn, Save, Invest, ESI. And he was talking about the concept of career hacking. We could also talk about salary negotiation. But what's really important, and it was embedded in this conversation, was the idea of Does your boss even know what it is that you do that does not make you interchangeable with just anyone else off the street, right? Like I could have this person or I could have that person. Why would I pay someone more when they're all interchangeable? And there's certain layers of competency. Like whenever someone's making a hire, they don't want to make a bad choice. Like a bad choice is someone you have to go through the process of letting go, actively letting go. But most people, most employees are tolerable, right? They're not bad enough to let go and it's not worth the hassle of letting them go. So that's the bar. And most people descend down to that because they don't see an incentive to do otherwise. They don't realize that they can affect change. They don't realize that there is a way, if not for this company, with any company, to use some of the practices that we're going to talk about through the lens of career hacking to, on average, be able to negotiate not 1% or 2% raises or 3% if you're the good employee, but 8% raises on average. Talk about combating inflation. Most people just assume the good raise is 3%, you know, and that's if you really get nail it. But ESI is over here talking about how he consistently was able to get 8, 10, 20% raises year over year. And Brad, the compounding effect on what that does to your net worth over time, like it's not 8% on what your initial salary was 10 years later. It's like that 8% is compounding each additional year. I mean, you're compounding on the raise you got the year before. It's incredible what it does to your income potential.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I mean, it truly is the same concept as compounding with our investments, right? And we think about how much of a difference it makes for a 1% difference in annual return on our investments. If you're talking about settling, as most of us do, as I did, for our 1, 2, 3% cost of living adjustment versus going out there and proving how invaluable you are, and we will talk about this, and getting 8 or 9% raises, right? I mean, the rule of 72 works the same way here. So if we're saying you get a 9% annual raise, you take 72 divided by that annual raise or return, let's say, in this case, 9%. So you divide 72 by 9, and that equals 8. And that's the number of years it would take to double. Okay. So you would double your salary in 8 years. Now contrast that, because the rule of 72 works the same way, with, let's say, a 3% return, or really more realistically, 2%, right? That's what a lot of people are getting. You take 72 and divide it by 2, right? And you've got 36. It would take 36 years, Jonathan, to double your salary with 2% raises, and it would take 8 years to double it with 9% raises. I mean, you're dealing with one lifetime here. So 36 years is a working lifetime for normal people, right? That is a very long timeline.
Yeah, completely agree, man. And it is incredible that people don't appreciate that compounding nature on the salary side of the equation, and like why this is a skill worth looking into. And when you're really digging into this, the difference between the bar and the 8% raises, so the bar that everyone settles at, which is like, hey, I think I've met all the metrics that were assigned to me or whatever, and maybe getting the 3% versus like that outlier 8%, is that you effectively transform into the linchpin. And what does that actually look like? Well, you know, most people think that the performance review is like the negative thing. It's like the sit down the boss has with you. And it's like, you got to look at all those stuff together and, you know, whatever. You're not waiting for them to give you the performance review. You're proactively setting it up. You're proactively looking for, and this is kind of what it looks like. It looks like understanding what your boss's goals are. So it's very easy if you're just doing a once a year conversation with your boss or with your mentor, whatever, whoever it is. They're just telling you one way what's actually happened and matching what you did to the KPIs, right? What if in a proactive way, you're having conversations throughout the year? Nothing that happens in the performance review is going to be a surprise to you. You're asking them proactively, maybe taking them out to lunch or maybe just sitting down with them or however, whatever it looks like, having an extra chat. You're talking about what their goals are. Like you're finding out what it is that their needs are. And some of their goals are represented by the KPIs. But it's also kind of masterminding with them about what it is they want to see happen. And then maybe proposing some ideas for what actually would be possible. And then agreeing on what you might actually be able to do to help, you know, the next layer of management achieve their goals. And so this is a process, maybe a quarterly process throughout the year, of maybe bringing them ideas that might be helpful to help them reach their goals, or, you know, showing them what has actually happened or what you're trying to do. And then at management time or at the performance review time, you're just celebrating that it actually happened. This is like people don't do this. It doesn't happen. When you are the one that's doing it, it shows like a level of awareness and a level of someone that is making their life easier. I mean, they are responsible for getting certain outcomes as well. They're on this performance curve also, you know, unless it's the founder, but even the founder has something that they are trying to accomplish, something that gets them there. And if you can understand what it is, maybe it's something that's entirely in your scope, or maybe it's something that's out of it, but they don't have anybody. They're trying to like figure out how to put a job listing together to get somebody to do it. This is a way that you can start building your talent stack and actually bridge your way into a new space that is something that you want to try.
Yeah. And this is really interesting. And like you said a bunch of minutes ago, are you distinguished from anybody else in your job in terms of your boss or your VP of your departments in terms of their eyes, right? Like, are you just another cog in the wheel? Can they distinguish between you and the person who's in the cubicle or the office next to you? And I think, Jonathan, what you're describing is make them terrified to lose you, right? Because of what you bring to the table.
Right. Not because you're going to burn the building down.
Right. No, because, seriously. Right. Like, what problems are you solving for that VP of the department? How are you making her life easier? And they should think about that. And they should know. They should just know that you are the person that makes their life easier. And a lot of that comes down to, as you're talking about, and as ESI mentioned on that episode so far back, is sit down proactively and talk about what those things that you're doing actually are. Be that one person who sits down, who isn't terrified to go into their office, but proactively reaches out and says, okay, this is what I'm doing. This is what I plan to do. And I'm going to touch base with you in X number of months, 3 months, 6 months, whatever it may be. And we're going to go over the success, right? When you are solving problems, I mean, Jonathan, you're a small business owner. If someone on your team is solving problems for you, is proactively looking at what are the other people in your industry doing? How are they solving problems? I mean, if that person is coming to you with this entire list, they're not just going through the day-to-day. They're going to the ends of the earth to solve problems that you might not even know you have. I mean, what would you do to keep that person?
I would do a lot. And to your point, like, all right, you have an idea and you execute the idea, and then the idea doesn't work. Do you know, like, all right, first of all, it's amazing that someone is willing to step up and have an idea. Do you know how many people have an idea and then like, all right, so that's great. That's one level of difference between you and the rest. All right, I had an idea. Level two. All right. They had an idea and they took action. Wow. Very few people do that. All right. Level three, they tracked, did it work? Level three. And then level four, it didn't work. The first ideas rarely work. Now people stop there. It's okay if it didn't work. You can even go to your boss and say, this didn't work. Here's the next thing I want to do to tweak this idea, right? Like, that is like such a next level thing. In any business, all businesses have similar goals, right? I mean, they may have a different product, they may have a different mechanism, but they have similar goals. And if you can be the one that has the idea that doesn't work, and then can analyze why it didn't work, and then tweak the new iteration, and then make forward progress on that. Einstein, you know, built the light bulb on 1,000 ideas. It's the same thing.
Edison.
Einstein, Edison. They're all great people. Just throw them all in there together. Thanks, Brad. Appreciate that. Better you than a feedback in a comment. Doesn't even know who Edison is. Anyways, this is why we have the incandescent and now the LED. You know, these are the types of things, like, you got to be able to iterate your ideas and move forward. But it is that forward growth, learning what doesn't work, but has been now checked off and then iterated on top of to something that does work in the context of a performance review, where you can show them what has gone into that and whether it worked or didn't work and how it's been iterated. And did you ultimately end up hitting the goal, is incredibly valuable. And it's a conversation like they haven't had before. And here's the thing, and we're going to get to this in a second. All of the other options that we have available to us are based on what we have done. Just park that little thought. What if your boss is just a jerk? You thought you guys were going to be able to come to an understanding. You did all this incredible work and they didn't recognize you for it. Absolutely nothing. You got no raise, no accommodation. Well, guess what? The whole next phase of this is, what have you done? And regardless of whether or not they rewarded you financially or not for what you guys agreed upon with your goal setting, you now have all the juice we're going to need to start filling out the resume for the industry that you are already kind of wanting to go in, right? And you're going to see exactly how that comes into play in some of these other levels. Your current boss may not have valued it, but I can tell you, you set yourself apart from 98% of the current employee workforce that's out there, and another employer will, especially if you can figure out how to turn what you did into a story that shows what you might be able to do in the right environment. If someone can visualize you doing that, you can break into nearly any industry that you want. You know, you're bringing up this conversation and it's awesome. Like, we're going to try and do all this and we have two outcomes. They could give you what they want or not. But even that is its own art form. This is a problem to be solved.
Yeah. And Jonathan, we're talking about, okay, how can you succeed within your existing job? And that's perfect world, especially if you like it, right? We're going through your little flowchart here in terms of, okay, can I solve problems? Can I make myself invaluable? And then there's a real high likelihood you're going to get raises far exceeding the piddly little 2 or 3%. But there's also a plausible outcome where that doesn't happen. Okay, what do you do then? I think we've seen some themes in terms of salary negotiation, and we've seen themes in terms of, okay, you might still want to stay in this industry, but sadly, often you have to go to a different company, or at the very least threaten to go to a different company in order to get those significant raises. It's unfortunate that the world works that way, but it does work that way to a large degree. So I think those two things I'm curious to talk through.
Right. So the art of salary negotiation, and we'll have a couple episodes where we've dedicated whole episodes to this. We have two in particular, and we'll mention those shortly. But salary negotiation can happen with your current employer through the art of career hacking, or it can happen, like as Brad just pointed out, you can go to another company and use the same thing. Now, either way, and the data will probably suggest, as Brad was pointing out, the highest raises are always happening when you go from one employer to another. But having said that, you could dust off your resume, you could dust off the process, you could go get an offer from another company, you know, using the salary negotiation process. And then if you really wanted to stay, you could, you know, give your current employer the opportunity to pay more if they wanted to. This is one of those things where you probably shouldn't be bluffing. And if they do offer you more, you should never use that tactic again, right? You've gotten that one freebie chip in there, but they're not going to want you to hold them hostage to this type of strategy every year. All right. So when we're interviewing for various jobs, there's the job search process. There's the job application process, which involves personal branding and resume building. But let's say you've actually gotten the interview and you're in the interview process. That's really where salary and an offer has been extended, or rather you're on the verge of getting the offer. That's really where the art of salary negotiation is coming into place. And so one of the things that need to come to mind is, like, when do you talk about salary? And this is actually one of those easier things, is you should really try not to talk about salary in the early stages. There are laws in this country that protect you in terms of, like, a current employer is not allowed to ask you what you made in your other job. Not all employers follow the law in this case, though. There are going to be cases where you think that's the law, and it is the law, and the employer asks you for your current salary or what you are making in your current profession. And I would say you should not tell them, or rather we can come up with some artful language to avoid that. And so I'll give you some clever language that you can use around that. So an employer says, what were you making before? In which case, if you're going to defer, you could say something like, well, you know, I would need to know more about the responsibilities of the role before I would really feel comfortable talking about salary. You could say something along the lines of, well, I make it my personal policy not to discuss salary until we're actually at the offer stage, but I'm confident we could come up with something that's fair. You could ask them, like, well, you know, while I'm not comfortable talking about personal salary in this context, I am interested. Do you guys have a range for this position that you're interested in? You could put it back on them. You don't owe it to them. That's the big key. And if they keep forcing it, you can probably rule them out as a company you don't want to work for. Because again, in light of what we're talking about, every company needs you more than you need them.
Yeah, that's interesting. And certainly in the current environment that we're in, with potentially millions of open jobs, that's maybe never been more true, Jonathan. So yeah, I love your little strategies there. And in terms of, right, like, you can always find a way to put it back on them. You can liberally use silence, right? Like, you wait for the other person. Like, you don't have to fill the silence.
Yeah, and it's so okay for them to be in an uncomfortable silence. And it's the more power you have in your side of the court, the more you should just be enjoying it. You're not trying to make them feel awkward, but you're also perfectly okay with it because you're not desperate, right? Like, we have options. We're talking about building options into our life.
Yeah. And part of having options is having information, right? And sometimes an information asymmetry where you just simply have more information than them because you've gone to the ends of the earth to find that information. And I'm kind of exaggerating there a little bit, Jonathan, right? But like we have had guests talk about what are different ways to go about this, right? Like there's a lot of rating and ranking sites. I know Glassdoor is one. And there are these sites that list, because a lot of people do wind up on the short end of the stick or short end of the straw, whatever the saying is, because they never had the information. And it was so difficult to find. And employers went out of their way to make it so that people didn't talk about salary. And now there's been a great move in terms of fairness and openness. And a lot of this information, thankfully, is available online, Jonathan.
Yeah, absolutely. So Glassdoor is one of those types of companies that can give you kind of a hint. I mean, you shouldn't be flying blind. You should have a general sense for what the range is. You can certainly ask around. You know, someone that has been at the company before but left is a great opportunity to kind of find out. You know, there are different ways to get closer to what that number is. But you can also ask for their number before revealing yours. So, you know, talking about the episodes, we talked with Tori Dunlap and Financial Mechanic. Financial Mechanic, that was episode 211, choosify.com/211. And she had a script that I really liked for this. So you've gotten through the interview, you've had a chance to just show them what you've done or tell them what you've done, not what you would do. Show them what you've actually done in the past. So going back to that brag board of things that you've actually done, so useful in this case. But anyways, here we are now. We're about to talk into salary and you're about to ask them what the salary is. It's time. So here's a script that she kind of handed us in that episode. You know, something along the lines of, you know, I'm very interested in this position. I'd like to know more before we talk about money. I have a pretty good idea of the market rate. So going back to the idea, we've done the research. I have a pretty good idea of the market rate and I feel confident, you know, and I feel good that we can work out something, you know, that'll work for both of us. Do you have a range in mind for this position? This is not an aggressive thing. This is based on, you know, think about it. These people took the time to screen your application, to schedule an interview. Someone actually showed up on the call. Like they're happy to be talking with you. And now in this context, they also know that asymmetry of knowledge that Brad was talking about. They know that you already know, or at least that you might know what the range is and that you're giving them the opportunity to do the range, right? That is phenomenal. Like at this point, you know, do you have a range in mind? This is the sweet spot question. What you will find when you're using this in many industries, and this was based on Financial Mechanics experience, the range they gave was $15,000 to $20,000 higher than what she would have said if she had just said a number herself, right? Now, it doesn't always work because some companies are cagey, but you need to understand, you don't know how long what the turnover was for this company. Many of these interviewers have not interviewed thousands of people. You may only be the eighth or ninth person they've done, and they haven't given an interview to anybody that's as impressive as you are based on the strategies that you bring into this conversation. And they haven't been hit with that question before, and they really want you, and they don't know what you know, and they have a range that's far different than what you imagined. Like there's nothing but upshot in the scenario that we just described.
Yeah, I love that. You have to wonder, you always look to human nature. And I wonder if there's something there where that question or the way that that's phrased is almost like a hacking the OS of like humanity or something. Like I look for little things like that. I went back to Robert Cialdini's famous book, Influence, and there are the different rules of influence. And one of them is the law or the rule of reciprocity. And it's like when you give to someone, there's some aspect of humanity that the people feel the need to reciprocate. And now this obviously isn't pertinent to what we're talking about here, but it's like one of those hacking the human OS. It's just part of it. And it's not done in a Machiavellian way, obviously, or shouldn't be, nor is this, Jonathan. But it reminded me of that in that question might elicit a higher range because, yeah, like you said, that person may not have a ton of experience. They may be super impressed by you. They may think you know more. And then therefore, they are not going to lowball you out loud, right? It's easy to lowball someone on an email or something, but to do it to your face after you just asked this incredibly insightful question, I think there's something there. So that's to be continued. Obviously, we're not doing the social science research here on Choose FI Live.
We're not doing social science, but we are doing a little bit of scripting here. So we're going to build on this, right? So at this point, they have set a number, and maybe that number was $10,000, $15,000, $20,000 more than you even had in your mind, depending on the industry. Got to realize some industries are like in these tight bands. They just really are. Not that there's not outliers, but they're tight bands. Other industries, I mean, remote work is opening up. There's some places in California where the starting salary is $120,000. The starting salary for the same job here in Virginia would be like $60,000, but it's remote work. So you can get a California salary here in Virginia. Like, this is the type of thing we're seeing all the time. We see that the California to Houston disconnect is happening all the time. You have no idea. What you think is an absolute lock in a world of remote work could absolutely not be. So just keep that in mind. Here's the script. They've given you the range. Maybe your mind was blown. I mean, this is a job. It has remote work. It's got all your benefits included. I mean, it's your dream job. And they just offered you a number for their range. You know, you had in mind like $40,000, $50,000. They just said their range is 80 to 100. And you're like, oh my goodness, what's going on? All right. So, you know, with a total deadpan straight face, not looking like maniacal at all. Here's the script the financial mechanic gave us. And she said, I'm excited about this opportunity. I know we can agree on a starting salary. So based on, you know, the market, what I've been learning, the standard of living, other opportunities that I'm looking at, some goals that I've set for myself, I would expect to be at $80,000 to $100,000, you know, within the next 12 months. And what you're doing in this case, you're inserting the next two. So if they said 60 to 80K is their range, you're saying, okay, I would expect to be at the, you know, 75 to 95 range within the next 12 months. And what you're doing here is the low end of the range is actually your upper end, right? It's actually your upper end, but you already know what they set out. So you can have some flex here. The low end of the range is actually your upper range. Now, at this point in time, what you need to know is there's zero chance, the way this conversation has been framed, there's zero chance they're going to tell you you're insane. It won't happen because both of you are speaking the same language. It's a range. So you're only going to get one of three responses. You're going to get, yep, we can do that. Now, the bad news is if that happened, you know, they had a lot more to give. You weren't even close. Number two is, okay, you know, that's a little more than what we budgeted you for. We're going to start you, you know, we were planning on starting you at, you know, and they'll give you a number. And now this is a good thing. And it means that you are in the negotiation process. And the third option is the, you know, that's a little bit more than we were planning on paying. This is the insert right here. They've just told you they had a number in mind as the cap at which they were willing to pay you. That was different than the initial range that they laid out. So at that point, just find out what it was. Okay, well, what did you have in mind? You know, what did you want? So now you've nailed it. They're not going to be mad at you and they're not going to be angry. There's wiggle room in every offer. And you have been able to use just human nature and predictability to get to a way where you're not in an antagonistic relationship. You got to keep in mind though, with all of this, that was just the salary. We still have things like insurance to talk about, retirement, bonuses, stock offering. You know, how much time off am I going to get? Are they going to offer you a transportation, you know, accommodations, education? Are you going to continue all of these different things? This is how you're putting together. And I'm going to link to that financial mechanic interview along with her website in here, just how the skill set. Nobody knows this. And if you can make this what you do, you're only going to need to use this, you know, three or four times throughout your career. And it's going to result in you making double or triple what any of your peers are making because you can take it to any employer. One employer may say no. Employers at large are going to gobble this up because no one else does this. They take the lower end of the range it's offered and they're grateful. It's a stack of skills. Interviewing is one of them. We just laid out the case that could be made there. We don't need to stop there, but like, I hope that everybody realizing this, whether they're satisfied with the current job or they want to move to a new employer or a new industry, recognizes that this is something they could spend some time practicing with a friend, with a spouse, with a partner. Like, this is a skill set they should have because their interview are very structured. You know, we always think about those questions that Google's going to ask, like, hey, you know, if you could only have one thing in your fridge, what would it be? And then they determine whether to hire you. And maybe those questions still exist and they speak to problem solving. Maybe the reality is all employers are coming from the same playbook. And what they really want to know is, can you do the job? And then everything else, if they're confident of that, everything else is a negotiation around the margins, depending on whether or not you can frame it in a way that they should give you the higher end. And this does that.
Yeah, it certainly does. And like you said, there was something really critical in there also is you can practice this. That's actually a cool aspect. Like, the first time that you're going through this script should not be the very first time you're doing this at the highest stakes, right? When you're actually going into whoever, either for the new job or your existing job and trying to get that raise. You can run through this with a friend, a family member, a spouse, a significant other, whoever it may be. You should be running through the reps so that this feels second nature and it doesn't feel forced. So I know that's kind of a little point, but I think it's really important because ultimately here we are talking about a script. And Jonathan, like we've talked about so many times, like I was scared to death to do this when I was in my job, and I never asked for the raise. And just having this information, I would have done it. I know in my heart of hearts that I would have. So these little tips, I think, are the difference between someone actually doing this and not. It's important to really slow down on them.
A hiring manager will actually, if you do it the right way, if you don't make them look like a jerk, if you can actually make it easy for them to say yes or no, and that's key, whatever happens, you need to be the picture of grace. The practice should not just be the person saying yes, right? It should be someone saying no and being able to accept that with grace. If a employer ends up saying no, a potential employer ends up saying no to the salary negotiation, you could burn the bridge. Alternatively, you can recognize that you've kind of built out a network. You got extra reps in. There's a chance that they think maybe there's someone else that's going to work and they're going to have second thoughts and it's not, and they're going to come back to you. There could be a situation where they think of you a few months from now and they come back to you. There's no incentive for you to burn the bridge here, right? And you're getting all these reps in around the time. Also, just because one company says no or doesn't end up giving you the offer doesn't mean another one wouldn't double or triple your salary. There's huge variances. Like, you have no idea what's on the back end of what an employer is able to do, right? And so you should not take it personally if they say yes or no. Yes, you control what you can control, and that could be to increase your game and how good you are at the interview process, right? Part of this is, like we just talked about, the salary negotiation. An interview is made up of different components, and a lot of them is, tell me what you would have done in this scenario, or what you would do here, or how you would handle. You know, we can work on the different parts of our interview game. And again, now going back to the career hacking aspect, which is why you don't separate these out. If you proactively took the time in your current job to think, how can I improve this? What can I do? And you think about what you've actually done and the stories you can build around that are so above and beyond what normal people do, and you can weave that into a conversation, then if they ask you something that you have no experience with, an interview is an opportunity to tell a story. It's an opportunity for you to take any question that they asked, and they ask about something that you don't even know what it is, but you have a sense for what they're going for, and you translate out of that. You say, okay, well, you know, I hadn't actually used that software specifically, but let me tell you, you know, that it sounds very similar to this stack. And I was able to pick this stack up at about 3 months. And it actually enabled us to test this functionality out for our users. And we were able to implement this, and these are the results we would get. And so, yeah, I would absolutely say, you know, just based on my prior experience, this is the direction that I would want to take us. And this is what I would be able to do if I needed to on-ramp a new skill. It's a game of ping pong. They're hitting you the ball. And you could just let the ball go off the table because you haven't fielded that exact thing before. Or you could take whatever they handed you and you could use the next 5 minutes to demo something, move it to an area of your comfort. We need to demonstrate technical proficiency at whatever job we're applying for. We also need to demonstrate that, like, we can be the person that might, right? This is what people are relying on when they have a college degree. Oh, they got a college degree. They can probably learn stuff, right? And that, I don't even care what profession it is. Like, 90% of the time, unless the licenses involve a degree, is just saying they're probably the type of person that can learn stuff. But if people don't follow up in the interview with how that might actually be true, they're at a disadvantage over you without a degree in this particular area that has been able to demonstrate how they might be able to. A employer can visualize this person being the good fit. So think about this relationship that's being formed through the interview as an opportunity to demonstrate you're personable, that you care about whatever the thing is, that you can learn, you can become who they need you to be, that you have certain skills that you can demo out. And, you know, on the back end of all of that, the salary negotiation piece is going to unlock far more income potential than someone that hasn't listened to this podcast episode. So thank you to everyone that's actually listened to this episode. Hope you've gotten a lot of value from that. We'd like to follow this up and, you know, put together some resources for you around this. I'll just say this one thing. When Brad and I started this 4 years ago, we were speaking from a belief that this was possible, but without absolute proof that it was, right? It's a strong bias that this is probably where it's headed. And I in particular had a cynicism around that the degree was really a good substitute for all the stuff that we just laid out. Now, having said that, around 2 years ago, I helped Bradley Rice build out this Talent Stacker program to help people break into tech, help people break into Salesforce. And over the last 2 years, many of you know, there have been quite literally 500 to 1,000 people that have broken into the tech industry without going back to college by using just kind of like a skills-based process. And the starting salary for Salesforce admins, which is the role, the job that people are breaking into inside of tech, the starting salary is around $74,000 starting out. And I mean, I've been able to personally witness people from all walks of life, whether they were working at Walmart prior, they were music teachers, truck drivers, you know, they had a background in tech, they had never done anything in tech. I've seen people use kind of this methodology to the degree that this is just science, right? I mean, there's a science to just this process, and it's, you got to have the skills. And you have to have something that indicates you have the skills. You have to be able to get on an interview and show what it is that you actually have done. And that experience can be paid experience or it can be volunteer experience, but you need to be able to show what have you done and convey all of that in this point of time. And I can just tell you, like, this is now, I am a believer in this to such a degree that everything that I thought before, but from an uninformed place where I couldn't prove it out, this is the way the world is moving. And we're at the front end of this. And you, if you're practicing this, you are at the front end of this. People do not realize this. And they're giving bad advice all the time for someone that's unhappy with their first career choice and just saying, well, yeah, you know, probably you should just go back to school and get another degree in this. No, there's not enough time. When we're talking about 5 to 10 year pastify, you do not need to dedicate two of those years and $20,000, $40,000, $60,000 to going back and getting a mulligan to what you could have done when you were 17 or 18. It's just completely unnecessary. We can have a legitimate, intellectually honest conversation around whether the 17 or 18 year old should do that. I'm willing to do that completely separate for this. But in the context of inflation protection through earning potential, this is the reality. We've handed you the roadmap for crushing it in your current career or going across the street. And for those of you that got to the end of the Venn diagram and said, I'm disgusted by my industry, I'm disgusted by everything that had to do with what I'm doing currently, and I want to break into something new, you can certainly explore all the options that are out there. But if you're interested in the Salesforce that I mentioned very briefly, wasn't the point of this conversation, you can find out more about that. I do think it's a real opportunity that, like, literally hundreds of people in the Choose a Vibe community personally have, like, messaged us to say, hey, they checked it out. It's the real deal. They're excited about it. You can find out more information about that at chooseavibe.com/career. It's chooseavibe.com/career. Brad, final thoughts go to you on earning power, the best protection against inflation.
Yeah, it's something that, like we said, I had not considered, certainly at the outset of my FI journey. But I think Mr. Buffett is exactly right. This is something that, as we always say, control what you can control. And to a large degree, this is within your control. And it's much more within your control than I would have thought, certainly 5 or 7 years ago. And I think that's a really hopeful thing. We talk about not only the control, but having some power and agency in your life. And that's what this feels like to me, Jonathan. We're talking about negotiating your salary. We're talking about making yourself invaluable at your job and solving problems. We're talking about, if I don't like the career that I picked and truly don't like it, I'm not stuck here forever. You talked about this one particular instance that so many people in the Choose a Vibe community have benefited from and in Salesforce, but it doesn't end there, obviously, right? Like, we talked in passing about Google has something, Google certificates or certifications. There's a ton of ways to learn online inexpensively and pick up significant skills that can help you earn way more money than you ever anticipated. And I find just this whole conversation really, really hopeful.
It is. It absolutely is. And those salary ranges that are out there, you know, and those types of adjacent jobs, those skill-based adjacent jobs, like, even if you don't know how to code, I mean, I'm serious. It's not just like, do you know how to code or not? The range that we're talking about, starting salaries, $70,000, upper end of those salaries, $250,000, $300,000. There is no, take your imagine, whatever number you came up with in your imagination and said, oh, well, probably this is what I would have to settle for. And then just throw that out the window, double it or triple it. And to say you don't need to go back to college to get those types of numbers. That's just the reality. So there's a whole world out there. You have the rest of your life. Don't settle and take action. All right, my friends, go to chooseavibe.com/career for more information. The fire is spreading. We'll see you next time as we continue to go down the road less traveled.